Oh yeah! It's the O, the Z, the Oz. That's me, Brooklyn, Brownsville, Urban View. Y'all know what we do, the perspective. Today's topic, Boy George, Puerto Rican James Bond. Got the interviews, chip, hip, 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 just for you. And when we're through, I'm sure you'll have your view. Gonna drop it, chop it, brush it. Let's get up and touch it. Yes, yes, y'all. Yes, yes, y'all. Once again, it's the O, the Z, the Oz. That's me, Brooklyn, Brownsville, Urban View. Y'all know what we do. Today's topic, Boy George, Puerto Rican James Bond. Now, let me tell you, a lot of people might not be familiar with this person unless you are distinctively from the Bronx. And let me tell you, this individual, he did so much in the Bronx back in the days, it's ridiculous. He was putting the work in. And that work, man, just like went crazy. He had a short run. Short run. It wasn't a long run. But let me tell you something. It was one that made history in the Bronx for sure. You know, people like Fat Joe and them, they can tell you stories about this youngin, man. He was getting it. He was getting it. No doubt, man. He was getting it. Now, here at the Urban View, you know, we don't glorify, you know, drug use or, you know, that nasty, dirty street life. But we have to bring these issues out and these stories out so the people know what's happening on the street, what has happened, so that we can divert ourselves in a different direction in the future. Learn from your mistakes, you know. If you don't learn from your mistakes, you will burn from your mistakes as you go on in life. Please believe me. So this individual, Boy George, which is the name that he was tagged with, you know, back in the days, I'm sure you know Boy George, you know, the pop star back in the 80s, and he was getting his thing in overseas, but there was a Boy George that was mean, gritty in the streets of the Bronx. That's right, boogie down, man. And he was getting it. So I ran across this story, and I wanted to share this with you because I thought it was kind of rich in Bronx history. I know I always raise up, you know, for Brooklyn. That's my shit right there, Brownsville per se. But today I want to tap into some of the street stories from the Bronx and this individual, Boy George, because I think his story is one that needs to be told, you know, because sometimes we got to learn. We definitely got to learn that sometime we got to lean back.
St. John's is a residential building at 651 Southern Boulevard in the South Bronx. The building was located near a stretch known to law enforcement officers as the Westchester Strip. Outside the building, four lookouts walk. Others perch on nearby fire escapes, while two runners steer the streets. The thick metal door to a first-floor apartment, 1C, is framed with cement, sending a familiar message to the people who occupy the building: you don't pause here unless you want some. Behind the hole in the door stands a pitcher, who hands out glassines. Red, yellow, and green bulbs flash him instructions from a homemade panel nailed to the floor. Upstairs, in another apartment, the dealer works. He places the tiny bags of heroin in the dumbwaiter and sends them downstairs. The pitcher has no way out of the first floor apartment but up. Sheet metal, pipes, bars barricade all windows. There can be no skimming of the product, because there is no conversation, because there are no phones. It is very organized. The lookout signal to the dealer, a raised baseball hat, a touch to the face, and the dealer hits the appropriate switch, translating his instructions into color. The pitcher responds to light drop after drop, only knowing how much heroin to deliver. The steerer just knows how much he takes in, the exact amount to be offered up. At the end of the 80s, while America concerned itself with the consequences of crack, and crack dealers continued in that hyper trade, Boy George was running five heroin locations in the South Bronx, including 139th and Brook, one of the oldest and more profitable heroin venues in the borough. Whoever acts gets the prize, experience taught Boy George that. And the more severe the action, the better the prize. According to federal prosecutors Henry DePippo and Patrick Fitzgerald, by the time he turned 18, Boy George was a dealer of the major league. In late 1988, when he was 20 years old, Boy George was the primary source of heroin in the South Bronx, employing more than 50 workers and grossing about $250,000 a week. The brand name of this teenager's heroin was Obsession. The logo on its little bags was a Red King's crown. Although he was an accomplished businessman, manipulating forms of threat and people's fears, Boy George remained a child. Personality was his certain gift, impudent, streetwise, disarming, as cautious as he was searching, Boy George was charming and mean. He always was a tough boy, but he earned his way to living large, expensive toys and outrageous risks and an entourage of eager, less well-equipped kids. Government documents describe the estate he bought in Puerto Rico, with $140,000 in cash, and the stable of cars he kept in America, BMWs, Porsches, and Mercedes-Benzes. He customized his favorites with $12,000 ostrich skin interiors, 630-watt stereos, 10-track CD players, televisions with VCRs, cellular phones. Several were worthy of James Bond, whom George revered. Rear license plates that slid into side compartments and exposed blinding beams of light, secret compartments for guns. One Mercedes released gobs of oil from its tail, another, large nail-like tacks. Boy George's business, which he called Tuxedo Enterprises, positioned him at a height from which he could only fall hard. And so, his reign would end in him being sentenced to life in prison with no option for parole. Back up to the summer of 1985, he is 17 years old, sleeping on Bronx Park benches. He brushes his teeth and rinses his light brown face in the dribble of fire hydrants. He had always been meticulous about his appearance. This was his coming-of-age moments. Washington and 166th Street in the Bronx was easily one of the South Bronx's most dangerous locations. Rusted stoves jut out of broken windows. Scrap yards interrupt lot after lot of garbage rot. He had just been promoted from lookout, and two black males stood close by. They were engaging in the same activity, slinging drugs. A car comes, George takes the money, heads into the dingy hallway, and that's that. The process repeats. Another dealer is already out to the next car. The third dealer moves across the street, where junkies lurch toward him on foot. In this square neighborhood, the only other businesses, besides narcotics, are run by tired men in crumbling caves, stray mattress shops, where soiled mattresses are hocked, then reupholstered, and auto parts shops, the same, but with cars. The sounds are a mix of infants, gunshots, the reverberating shouts of radar, the day's code word for undercovers, and singing. The last comes sounding out from the storefront churches, the voices of grandmothers and still young enough children. 1 year of slinging and now you can see the come up. George was still a teen, but now, Hess pulling up his white Mercedes on 166th and Washington. He wears clean Levi's, a Prestige Odd, a sweater, beside him sits a pretty girl. He is a manager now. The Torres brothers allow him to collect their money counted, pack it, do peril, drop it, and to supply their dealers with Blue Thunder, the brand of which Boy George is partially in charge. He hires employees, some triple his age. If I can trust you, I can kill you, he will say. And he'll also say that he hires individuals, not hoodlums, not freaks, not bums. These uncles and ex-cab drivers and teenage sons of ex-cab drivers open the spots by 9 a.m. and run them through to the next morning. If the dealers or runners or lookouts or steerers need weapons, need assistance, if they need to talk to someone at any time, they beep Boy George. He shows up instantly. If he beeps them, coding in his 666, they call him back immediately. Workers are not to leave their spots to go to City Island to eat or to the movies or to White Castle, or to mess with no girls, or go standing with their crew. If the spots aren't fed and they don't got no reason why, if there is any problem, he will confront them once. And if a customer or dealer has a complaint as to the quality of Blue Thunder, Boy George delivers. If this isn't good, you give it back to me. I get it back and I give you something fresh. I don't like to not have the answers. I don't like the I don't knows. Excuses are for assholes. Everybody has one. Just set me up right, don't trick me. Luis Guzman, a South Bronx legend, gave George his street name around this time. It was a joke. It stuck, boy, George says. It's nice, it's different. It's not like calling Chino, or calling them red or lefty, or fingers. When you say boy George, you're talking about the singer or you're talking about me. Years earlier, when Luis was pitching heroin in an empty lot, George was afraid to walk by him on his way to elementary school. To have been christened by Guzman, boy George thought in his childish willfulness, was an omen and a good one. The obsession organization Boy George ran other brands named Candyland, Delirious, and Sledgehammer leased a pool of 10 luxury cars from OJ's car service in Queens. The drivers, all men, could be paid up to $100 an hour to remain on call. It was at OJ's that Boy George met Ward Johnson, an older Jamaican hustler better known as 6-0. 6-0 became Boy George's first lieutenant, and when the obsession operation fell, 6-0 would become the prosecution's primary cooperating witness. 6-0's testimony fleshed out the internal workings of Tuxedo Enterprises and freed his own son from the consequences of his involvement. 6-0 himself pleaded guilty to a grab bag of charges: conspiracy to distribute heroin, using and carrying firearms in relation to narcotics, possession of 10.46 kilograms of heroin, evading taxes on $491,550 in income in 1988. Tuxedo Enterprises originated with Boy George cutting and bagging heroin at the kitchen table of his Bronx apartment with 6-0, a kid named Weasel, and their girlfriends. Weasel was from the neighborhood. Weasel rarely lifted his head or his eyes, but he was malleable and seemed eager to please. The product sold well, and George rented another apartment as a mill. He revived the Obsession brand name by making it his own. Its original managers, conveniently, were dead. Boy George would buy units of heroin, usually about 700 grams, from his Chinese suppliers, whom he privately referred to as fried rice, and passed them along to 6-0, who would store them and distribute them to the cutting mills. At the various mills, South Bronx, Walkapan Project apartments, and some hotel rooms in Manhattan and New Jersey, the food was cut, diluted, and packaged in pre-stamped dime bags for retail sale. As much as its distributors and customers savor its purity and smell, heroin is not a product anyone keeps around. When everything runs exactly as it should, it takes less than 72 hours for the drug to make its way from the distributor to a customer's nostrils or veins. Since time can be lost setting up mills and orchestrating distribution strategy, all workers must remain on call, hence the beeper. Boy George's mill workers were girlfriends of his male associates and their friends, who often became girlfriends themselves, and it was their job to cut the heroin with mannite, weigh it, and bag it in the pre-stamped glassines, each with its Red Crown logo. They would then tape the glassines and package them in bundles in counts of 10. 5 bundles, wrapped in newspaper, made a brick. One former mill worker, who served 11 years with no parole for conspiracy, said they sometimes snorted coke to stay awake through the long shifts. Older women, often the mothers or grandmothers of workers, could stamp the bags with the Obsession logo from their own project apartments, while they babysat the children. Lieutenants, like Weasel and another Obsession worker named Ralph Hernandez, delivered the bricks packed in shopping bags, knapsacks, or suitcases to the managers of the locations, which were known as stores. One spot was on 122nd Street and 2nd Avenue. From approximately April 1988 to April 1989, that location was managed by a dude named Rob. Other spots, the block-long building on 139th Street and Brook, 153rd, 156th Streets and Kirtland Avenue, which was a playground in a public housing project, 651 Southern Boulevard, also near a school, and 166th Street and Washington, the 10 square feet of corner where Boy George got his start. When all the glassines were gone, the location manager would beep Weasel or Ralphie, and they would take a driver from OJ's to pick up the money and bring it to 6-0, who recorded the transactions and did the payroll. 6-0 kept very good records. Location managers generally made 10 to 20% of the profit, depending upon the location, and were responsible for paying the lookouts, steerers, pitchers, and runners out of their share. Weasel and Ralphie, who also became a cooperating witness, earned $2,500 a week. 6-0 made $12,000. Women filled the lower ranks of the operation. For 12, 15, sometimes 20-hour shifts, they usually received $100. Boy George made roughly $45,000 a week. 1988 was a big year for drugs, and you can hear it all in the hip-hop. That year was the first anniversary of George's empire founding. He set up a deal with a man named Tony, a jobber. Tony introduced Boy George to Sinbad, to whom Boy George handed over $600,000 in cash. Sinbad stepped into a duplex and left through a rear exit with the money. Boy George had not cased the meeting point himself, but the problem was his. It was a setup, and Sinbad was gone with the money. But Tony was still there, and he would pay for this. For several hours, Tony was beaten by George and others, then taken to the Henry Hudson Parkway, near 86th Street, where Boy George shot him 4 times at close range. George hit associate and hitman, Kong, to track Sinbad down, while he paid off his Asian source with $600,000 of his own. George's quick response to the slip-up reinforced his relationship with the Asian connection and strengthened his reputation on the streets. By the end of May, Sinbad was dead and Kong earned a full-time as a sort of enforcer. For $1,000 a week he kept discipline within the obsession operation. George gave him the rundown on how to get the debts that was owed to their organization, speaking in code like this. Don't fall for the tricks about, oh, see you tomorrow. When you are dealing with someone who owes me money, you say, listen homie, I want to eat today. I'm not going to wait to tomorrow to eat. I want to eat right now. I want to eat today, I'm hungry. Pay up dude. That's it. At George's behest, Kong killed a man named Todd Crawford in the parking lot of the King Lobster restaurant that June. In November, Boy George arranged to have Kong meet Yvette Padilla in Ferry Point Park. Yvette had been accused of stealing a gold and diamond scripted obsession belt buckle from Ice, the supervisor of George's Sledgehammer brand. Ice carried a firearm, distributed firearms to his associates, and during the conspiracy, brought firearms to a public park in order to protect his drug operation from a robbery. Because Yvette robbed Ice, Kong shot Yvette, then, her body was dumped off the Triborough Bridge. Kong received a few vials of crack, a $5,000 cash bonus, and an invitation to the Christmas party. On Christmas Eve, 1988, the Riveranda, which was a ship, stood waiting for Boy George at World Yacht's 23rd Street dock. When he arrived at 7 p.m., everyone was clapping, and then they all boarded the ship. The cruise was about 2 hours, and there was 150 teenagers in black ties. Big Daddy Kane accepted $12,000 in cash for his 15-minute rap. Sapphire pocketed $3,000 without even performing. She refused to sing for the originally agreed upon $7,500 because she didn't have a private dressing room. The menu included steak tartare, skewered lamb, bocconcini, prime rib, and $12,000 worth of champagne. There were raffle prizes, winners to be announced by the host. First prize, a loaded Mitsubishi, second, $20,000 in cash. Home entertainment centers, a Macy's gift certificate, a trip to Disneyland, a night on the town. Nobody bothered to claim the $100 and $200 prizes. Everyone who had done anything was there. 6-0 received a gold Rolex and $50,000 in cash. Ice was given a brand new model 750 BMW. George also gave diamond-inscribed gold obsession belt buckles, appraised at $7,500 each, to 4 of his other top men. There were fights and there was flirting. One guest challenged a drunken dealer perched midway on the tip of the ship's boat to swim ashore. He didn't though. Another guest was stripped down to his underwear and left on the deck after a group beating he'd allegedly attempted to steal a young woman's diamond pendant. Another former drug lord also claims that he was in attendance. His name is Kevin Childs. Kevin Childs is responsible for the Don Diva magazine. Anyway, the seating arrangement was carefully planned, by location. There were lots of pictures taken, guys leaning forward, toasting, bloodshot eyes, abundant tables, groups of girls in off-the-shoulder taffeta swirls. It was a prom, open bar, no chaperones. Boy George paid for the tuxedo rentals, for everything. His bill from World Yacht alone, he paid for it all in cash, the guests didn't pay a thing. All paid dearly for the pictures later, though, when federal prosecutors pinned enlarged reproductions of them on the courtroom bulletin boards for the judge and jury to see. Giddy hard-earned glory boasting on the water. Image after image of fearlessness, of tired eyes, of youth. And like a little boy, Boy George had a Christmas wish. A half hour before the ship docked, he asked if he could visit the captain, and up he went. It was a rare moment of parody, where life reflected and respected Boy George's vision of his rightful self. Boy George's first childhood memory is of taking a bath in the kitchen sink and getting burned with hot water. His next is of looking out his apartment window and seeing a cat get hit by a car in front of his Tremont Avenue tenement. He remembers crying for the dead cat. He didn't have friends. We were always moving around, he says. I loved pets. I tried to keep dogs, but they were always getting hit too. Indio, his younger brother, learned a lot from George. How to carry himself, how to be careful. He showed him how to read. George was the bravest in the family. George's father left when George was 6 months old, and the boy would visit him whenever he could. Sometimes there were year-long gaps. His dad would end up owning a car service in Queens. George's relationship with his mother had always been tense. She beat him and Indio, regularly and badly. On occasion, she used an extension cord to whip them. She was overly possessive of the brothers, especially when it came to girls. George ran away when he was 10, his life was his business. His mother eventually received a PIMS order, parent with a child in need of supervision, from the court when George was 12. Soon after, he was sent to the Pleasantville Diagnostic Center, where he spent 3 months, then to St. Cabrini's, a group home in New Rochelle, where he was the youngest boy. The 8 Cabrini kids all lived together in a one-family, brick front corner home with 4 bedrooms, a lawn, fruit trees, skunks and raccoons. The house was in the transitional part of town, where the working class built into the upper middle and then onto the rich. The Cabrini kids attended the local junior high and high schools. They felt the normal pressure to assimilate, but, since all of them were poor, most of them withdrew from the New Rochelle kids instead. George was the only Puerto Rican on the New Rochelle High football team. To play, he had to quit his nighttime job stocking shelves at a nearby market called Shopwell. He got invited to the rich kids' parties, the girls' houses on the hill. George dragged his Cabrini friends along. After one party, George and 2 friends had stole some valuable silverware from one of the host's houses. In light of their success, he convinced his crew to take their talent to the surrounding sprawling homes. The police caught up with George at the local pawn shop. George took the rap for his crew and was sentenced to 13 months at Valhalla, a juvenile detention center upstate. George was loyal. A lot of the Spanish kids would hang out with the black kids in the homes, but when they get around the white kids, they act like they don't know them at all. George never forgot that his friends were his friends. Cabrini made him into a man. He was able to spread out and express himself different than he would around his brother and moms. He was hip to things and would begin to take things to the next level. He stayed in contact with his mentors at Cabrini after his departure. Boy George did his best. He employed childhood friends, friends of friends, family, and recruited Cabrini alums. His workers' own safety grew in proportion to the perception of his retaliatory powers, and he earned a vicious reputation and gave obsession that glow, that aura. Lieutenants and managers received gold belt buckles with their names, scripted in diamonds, and top dealers received customized red and white leather baseball jackets. The ornaments protected his workers and ranked them, publicly, in the order of their importance to the organization and in their proximity to him. A wise incentive program and an investigator's dream. At the beginning of 1989, Boy George purchased more real estate in Puerto Rico and, with the help of a financial consultant, looked into the possibility of opening a fast food mall with a McDonald's and a Pizza Hut and a church's fried chicken. He also began to transform the Puerto Rico estate into a permanent home. Wiretaps placed by the New York Drug Enforcement Task Force offered detailed discussions about the renovations, which were overseen by his girlfriend, who stayed at the estate with their sons. Workmen installed electronic security gates and paved a basketball court. George had obsession inscribed in tile on the bottom of his swimming pool, alongside the initials BG, for Boy George. Again, the guy was flashy. Sanford Katz, a veteran public defender who represented one of George's street managers, thought this about Boy George's actions. If you want to advertise, I am a drug dealer, then bring a Porsche into the South Bronx. You'll have every investigator and snitch paying attention. Boy George did, and they were. But to have the logo of his brand of heroin, which can be found all over the Bronx, on the bottom of his swimming pool. He was saying F you to the world. The expensive objects George flaunted surely said that to the poor streets that produced him. As did the dead competitors and colleagues planted as warnings each step along way. From the crying Puerto Rican kid in the tenement window, Boy George, only 21, had drastically upped his threshold for pain. According to government evidence, in 1986, while he was still working for the Torres brothers, George shot one competitive associate and injected another with heroin. Like most top-level dealers, the man did not use drugs. In 1987, after sharing an extravagant shrimp scampi dinner, he shot his dining companion and dumped his body off a bridge. The victim had disrespected Boy George to a friend, whose sister, unbeknownst to the victim, Boy George was dating. From then on, whenever a colleague or competitor needed that kind of taking care of, it was referred to as eating shrimp or being taken out for shrimp. Eventually, the phrase became an in-house obsession joke. That same summer, 166th and Washington became a wanted spot. George organized an ambush to clean out the competition, and at the end of the shooting, an uninvolved bystander was dead. A September 4, 1990, letter filed by the prosecution briefly notes another murder, this one of an unnamed man, an incidental three-sentence episode in a long list of violent acts that never made it to the jury. The encounter best reveals the blind spot where George's boyhood and ego crossed. That day, Boy George had a routine meeting with a higher-up and pulled his numerous...
When there's a Mikeson.
Now, you hear this. Very intricate, intricate operation. He had it cracking on many, many, many cylinders. Started from nothing. And look at him now. Crazy, crazy. Continue.
Boy George followed him and forced him off the road. He then stabbed the man a number of times, leaving him for dead in the front seat of his car. It didn't make any difference to George if the driver was dead or not, he'd done what he did. Before the money, life was the only thing. After, it could be carelessly flaunted or thrown away. Before, he trusted nobody because he thought anyone could hurt him. After, he thought he was so powerful that nobody could. And while Boy George worked his way through the chaos of his increasingly complex future, with guns and the other dangerous tools of his trade, the past snuck up from behind, an accumulation of 2 years of behaving like an extremely arrogant and savvy and talented unsophisticated kingpin kid. Back in August 1987, Boy George had met Luis Guzman outside the Baychester Diner. Luis had a connect. Proud of finally being considered the older dealer's real peer, Boy George went to the meeting himself. He was especially impressed with Luis by then, because he fully appreciated the accomplishments of the life. Street years are like dog years and Luis dodged raps better than anyone. At Luis's encouragement, Boy George sold 2 ounces of rock heroin to an unfamiliar man. He also bragged that his business grossed $250,000 a week, discussed his estate renovations, bemoaned the difficulty of shipping cars to Puerto Rico, flashed his diamond Rolex, and accepted $12,000 in cash. Days after his meeting with Luis, Mount Vernon detectives knocked on the door of the apartment George kept for his moms at 156th Street. The police were looking for George on an outstanding bench warrant for gun possession. George allegedly fled out a fourth floor window, an uncle was there, but he wouldn't talk. On their way out, the policeman noted a 1987 Mercedes on the impoverished street and started asking questions. Spooked, Boy George arranged for 6-0 to move the hot car. Just to be careful, he also told him to fold the cutting mill on East 213th Street and to set up shop at the Midtown Marriott Marquis Hotel. As an afterthought, George told his mother to stop by 213th Street for a final double check. The Mount Vernon detectives had tracked the Mercedes to 6-0's family home on Prospect Street in Yonkers. 6-0 kept several other apartments with other girlfriends at a weekly cost of $1,000 each. 6-0 spoke to the detectives. He said that he had received a call from George on August 30th to pick up the car on 520 East 156th Street and that he worked for George. The cops moved on to 213th Street and, believing George was inside the apartment and possibly armed, made a forcible entry. 6-0 had made a sloppy departure. Inside, in plain view, the cops found quinine, razor blades, white powder covering a table, glassine envelopes, and scales. A search uncovered shotgun shells, 38 caliber shells, 9mm shells, rifle shells, a rifle with a scope, 3 shotguns, a tranquilizer gun, a bulletproof vest, 3 bags containing large amounts of cash and drugs, and other boxes of ammunition. George's mother then arrived in a hysterical manner, inquiring as to what happened to her son. She said she'd last seen him on August 21st. Then, distraught, terrified, or perhaps even vengeful, she began to talk. His mom's made her son into a dealer. She even took out a student loan and set George up with the money. her own Mother's Day gift from her son, $5,000 in cash he took back to buy more drugs, and it was his mom's fault. George had $125,000 stashed at her house too, and he always carried a gun since he got heavy into drugs. The Mount Vernon detectives alerted the 47th Precinct, and the drug task force sent their people in. Meanwhile, the Midtown Marriott became a dorm. 6-0 arrived with boxes of glassines, scales, and a silencer, as the shifts of mill workers were beat in. Because of how militant George was, dealers had a better time cutting drugs when he wasn't around. Around this time, Boy George launched a new brand name, Delirious. It was the same cut as Obsession, but its blue logo, a crazed-looking man with a bulbous nose, spooked junkies. Within 2 months of the test market, Boy George shut down the line. He instructed the mill foreman to return production to Obsession full-time, believing that for a change, it was best to play it safe. The same week, Boy George met Luis and the undercover again. This time for lunch at Willie's Bar and Steakhouse, near the intersection of Westchester Avenue and Beach Street. George unloaded 600 leftover bags of Delirious and took $5,000 home. The undercover told George he'd had a hard time grinding down the rock, but 6-0 warned George that the guy might be a cop, so George didn't return the Connect's calls to his beeper. The arrests and seizures continued for months, still unconnected. On September 20, 1988, 100 glassines of Obsession were confiscated from the second floor apartment at the Southern Boulevard location, along with $4,400 in cash. Law enforcement arrested a dealer there, who was carrying 400 glassines of Obsession. A steer, named Ant, also led an undercover to a 10-glassine sale on January 5, 1989. 5 days later, the same undercover bought 40 glassines from Ant's brother at the same spot. While surveillance of the location increased, Boy George was discovering boxing. He became so enamored of the sport that he hired Hector Rocha of Brooklyn's Gleason's Gym to train him. Not counting traveling time, the workouts lasted a good 4 hours a day. Ant and his brother benefited from George's lack of attention and were promoted to manage the Southern Boulevard spot. They were arrested on February 8, just as they were passing $10,000 in cash between them in a brown paper bag. The agents made their move that same day. The first floor apartment yielded a loaded .22 caliber, a .357 revolver, a .38 caliber, and a .357 Magnum inside a safe. During a search of the East 165th Street apartment, the agents discovered $50,000 in cash and 5,600 glassines. The mill had by then been moved to 740 East 243rd Street. The task force knew it. The investigators could also identify whom they believed to be the key players of the operation. On April 6, 1989, Boy George ran a yellow light and was stopped by two policemen. They wrote him up and confiscated his box, a common practice, according to South Bronx Kids, then let him go. 6-0 later testified that Boy George often lost his beeper, that he'd get angry and drop it sometimes too. But this time the carelessness eventually mattered. In a Bronx precinct office, Boy George's beeper kept flashing phone number after phone number of his incoming business calls. On the 2-year anniversary of Obsession's founding, at the same time a federal judge was granting investigators permission to place a 30-day wiretap on Boy George's Morris Avenue home phone, he moved to remedy the slip-ups, pull in the reins, and increase control. "I gotta write my shit down somewhere secret and shit, I gotta code it up," he said to a friend, on April 5, 1989, the day before he was stopped for running the light, and less than a month before his arrest. Other phone conversations, which were eventually admitted into evidence, use Pig Lantin as his teenage organization's attempt at communication in code. In the following, during a period when shipments of heroin were delayed, George discussed the possibility of opening crack locations with ICE. This would become the most incriminating telephone conversation. But Boy George believes that it was Luis, his childhood hero and, according to George and his defense lawyers, a confidential government informant, who did him irreparable damage. 6-0, whom one former girlfriend and mill worker claims Boy George treated as a father, did at least as much. On April 30th, police officially established surveillance of the 243rd Street mill. Late that morning, Weasel and Ralphie left the building, each carrying a white plastic bag, jumped in an OJ car, and rode off. Soon after, the driver was arrested, 13 bricks of heroin in tow. That afternoon, Weasel and Ralphie were arrested as they left the mill with another white plastic bag, 800 Obsession glassines, to add to the climbing total. Early in the morning of May 1, at 2:35 a.m., investigators entered the building. 11 mill workers were apprehended with, among other things, blocks of mannite, 8 boxes of empty glassines stamped with the Obsession, Sledgehammer, and Delirious brand names, 5 grinding machines, and strainers. There were boxes of sealing tape and 3 triple beam scales. A ledger held attendance and payment records, complete with notes on workers who arrived late. And the police found the standard protections. Face masks, 2.38s, a 20-gauge pump shotgun, an automatic shotgun, and a 9mm MMP9 automatic rifle, better known as a street sweeper, all loaded and ready to go. Federal agents had been listening to Boy George's phone calls throughout the night. Earlier that evening, in a conversation with ICE, Boy George talked about breaking out of doing the Brown. Brown is heroin, which they coded as Jimmy James, as in James Brown the artist. At 11:06 p.m., as key people were being hauled in, 6-0 called George and told him he couldn't find some of their workers. I came through Washington and them dudes is gone. A lot of these people I can't get a hold to, man. At 8:36 the next morning, hours after the mill had been cleaned out, 6-0 woke George with another call. I gotta see you right away, 6-0 said. Bad, bad news. He made arrangements to meet George under some nearby streetlights and advised him, when you come out bring some money with you to break out. Yeah, Boy George says on the wiretap, and sighs. A half hour later he was under arrest. As he left his apartment building to meet 6-0, he found close to 40 federal agents waiting. According to Boy George, the feds drove him through Central Park on their way to Central Booking. As he looked out the window of the white Lincoln, one of the agents pointed to a seedling. See that plant? The cop asked. It's gonna be a tree when you get out. 33 Obsession workers had been arrested in the sweep. Of those, 24 pleaded guilty. In September 1990, Boy George went on trial on 14 counts, among them, conspiring to run a continuing criminal enterprise, also known as the Kingpin Charge, drug possession and distribution, as well as ownership of a page-long list of guns. He was found guilty of only 2. Attempted tax evasion and conspiracy to distribute heroin. He told his mother and girlfriends not to come to the sentencing if they were going to cry. He did not want anyone associated with him to give the prosecution that satisfaction. He deliberated over what to wear and expected a crowd. When the date arrived, in the spring of 1991, the judge told George that he was one of the most violent people ever to set foot in her courtroom, and that she had not in the long days of the proceedings seen any sign of regret or remorse. Boy George shook his head ruefully and smiled. Other than his family and the Newsday reporter, nobody showed for him. In the wake of the most recent South Bronx heroin busts, the same locations, another 30 workers, hawking the same brand of drug stray Obsession trials continued. One Obsession worker allegedly continued the drug operation under George's direction from jail, using the brand name, Raw. Sometime after this, things remained the same at 139th Street and Brook Avenue in the South Bronx. 8 fist-size holes, waist level, punched through the corner building's cement front wall. Imagine a moat surrounding the block-long building that's where the steers roam. They pivot and backhand fistfuls of cash into the holes. Arms stick out and pass glassines of heroin in return. At the rear of the building is a playground, an asset to the business, providing fine visibility and a labor pool. To have realized dreams as fierce as Boy George's required a hunger that was large. And so Boy George was a kingpin among junkies, hustlers, children feeding other people's fears. But this about wraps it up. This was the story.
Real talk, no filter, straight from the gut, Urban View. Y'all know what we do. Yes, yes, y'all. The story, Boy George, Boricua, Puerto Rican, James Bond, no diggity, no doubt. That's right. Name still reigns to this day in the Bronx. History, the mystery. That's right. Bronx, stand up, lean back. Y'all know. But with this being said, I just like to say that, you know, we need to be a lot more cognizant of our actions, because our actions are a reflection of us. We are a reflection of our actions. They go hand in hand. Now imagine if this man would have put that that savvy business sense into something proper, something legal. Can you imagine? He could have been a Puerto Rican Bill Gates. That's right. That's right. Like I said, he had a short run, but it was a hard run, a long run, you know? And the money was just running, running, running. Couldn't turn the faucet off. That's how it was. Bronx. So, I just like to throw out one thing real quick. Lost a very good friend, Ant-Man Richardson. Let me tell you, his family, Dwayne, Kev, much love. I love you all. You have my deepest, deepest condolences with the loss of Ant-Man. Brooklyn, Brownsville, a veteran. Please believe me. Till next time. We're going to keep this. We're going to keep this, you know, breezy. No doubt. Because let me tell you something. A lot of times, you know, we grow up and sometimes, you know, we don't show up with that. So we have to start showing up, you know, for our peoples and doing the right thing and making the right thing happen, you know, for us. Because, you know, it's for us, by us. It's like the FUBU, for us, by us. That's what we have to do. You know, we have to come forward, man, and be there for each other. You know, it's very essential, you know, especially coming from some of the lower poverty neighborhoods like the Bronx and some parts of Brooklyn, you know, and Queens and Staten Island, too, from Charlotte. That's right. It's all over. It's a New York City thing. But, you know, that shitty, gritty, you know, that's what makes us a part of, that's what makes us New York City. You know, all day, baby. Stand up. Lean back. Ten toes down. Chest out, shoulders back, snatch them collars, do the right thing, baby, stay black, stay strong, and always, always pay close attention.
We from the Bronx, New York, things happen. Kids clapping, love to spark the place. Half the cats in the squad got a scar on their face. It's a cold world and this is ice. Half a meal for the charm, brother, this is life. Got the phantom in front of the building, Trinity, yeah. 10 years been legit, they still figure me bad. As a young, was too much to cope with. Why you think the BX nickname it cook? Should have been called on robbery, extortion, or maybe grand larceny. I did it all, I put the pieces to the puzzle. Till as long, I knew me and my people was gonna bubble. Came out the gate on some flojo. Fat brother with the, he was the logo kid. Said my don't dance, he just pull up my pants and do the rock away. Now lean back, lean back, lean back. Lean back, come on. I said my don't dance, we just pull up our pants and do the rock away. Come on. Now lean back, lean back, lean back, lean back, come on.
R to the easy, M to the whiz eye. My arms stay breezy, the dawn stay fizz. I got a date at 8, I'm in the 740 fizz. And I just bought a bike so I can ride till I die with a matching jacket. About to cop me a mansion. My squad in the club, but you know they not dancing. We gangsta and gangsters don't dance with boogies. So never mind how we got here with the hoodies. Listen, we don't pay admission and the bouncers don't check us. And we walk around the metal detectors. And it really ain't a need for a VIP section in the middle with a dance floor, reckless check. Get steady, like my necklace started relaxing now. That's what the hell I call a chain reaction. See, money ain't a thing, we still the same. The flow just changed, now we about to change the game.
Said my n****s don't dance, we just pull up our pants and do the rock away. Now lean back, lean back, lean back, lean back, come on.